These are negotiations over how we're going to negotiate. The way that the war has now turned dramatically against Ukraine, not only militarily, but economically, the Russians are in an even stronger position to press ahead with, this is our take it or leave it. In fact, I saw, you know, in your recent debate where you abused that poor former general, Ben Hodges. I mean, good Lord, I almost called the cops. The man's kidding, taking a terrible beating here. As you tried to point out to him, and he was incapable of comprehending it, the Russians had one negotiating position in March of 2022 in which they were willing to allow Ukraine to remain intact. They just wanted assurances, protection for the Russian speakers in the Donbass, and NATO the hell out of Ukraine. But that got rejected. So, boom, next position, you get June 14th, 2024, where now we're keeping all five territories, and you still got to get NATO out, and you got to hold elections. You know, those were the key demands. And then Putin has said since then that if you don't take that deal, the next deal is going to be even tougher. Again, the point you made with General Hodges. So that's where this is headed. And so I don't think this is going to result in any kind of quick agreement. The Russians.
Well, and in fact, from your Sonar 21 piece, there's two things I want to point out or ask you to elaborate on. One is that you said this is not the, I think you put it, this is not the end of the beginning, but the, it's not the beginning of the end, but it's the end of the beginning. What do you mean by that?
So the end of the beginning, this whole process, this whole dance about, okay, we want to, ideally, we want to get Ukraine and Russia to sit down like they did back in March of 2022. But Russia's not, you know, they're not, I guess Ukraine's not ready to do that. And Russia's saying, okay, so what we're doing, we're in this whole process is trying to arrange a situation in which there can be talks to end the war between Russia and Ukraine. But that's what I mean. With the conversation that took place yesterday for almost 5 hours, about 4.5 hours, was all about, it wasn't so much discussing the particular issues. It was Russia saying, okay, look, these are our non-negotiable points. These are the areas where we think we can have discussions. But one of those points is we're not going to sit down with Zelensky. And we're not going to sit down with Zaluzhny. Ukraine has got to have a legally authorized representative. And then we can make progress in talks with Ukraine, but not until. So this is all this beginning to, it's lining the orchestra up, it's distributing the sheets of music, but they haven't started playing the symphony.
Now, one of the other things you put in that article, which I think bears some discussion, is that you said it was is important who wasn't at this meeting too, not just Europeans and the Ukrainians, but Sergei Lavrov. And you said that there was something that Putin had said apparently in public a couple of weeks back or something about the centrality of Lavrov. And I wonder if you could explain that.
Yeah, when he was at Bishkek, held a press conference at the end of this collective security organization for the former Soviet republics. He was asked about the negotiations, and he basically said, look, there's a process here, and a critical element of that process is Sergei Lavrov. The foreign minister's got the lead on this, and then the others that will participate will be Medinsky, who has been, up to this point, the one that met with the Ukrainians twice in Istanbul earlier this year, and Ushakov, who's the national security advisor to Putin. But Putin made a point that those three, when those three are involved, that's when the whole actual negotiation is underway. So that's why what this meeting with Witkoff and Kushner, it's just prep. And I think it's prep more to get them in a position where that they can fully help President Trump understand the inflexibility of Russia on certain of these terms. But, you know, the political situation in Ukraine is really going to be the major stumbling block. Russia's not going to make any kind of deal, sign any kind of document with Ukraine until there are new elections and new leadership in Ukraine that are legally constituted. Putin is a lawyer, and he's a stickler for that. And the Russians generally are sticklers. And this goes to something else that, you know, Ben Hodges told you, oh, the Russians have broken every agreement. God, you know, how hard do you have to work to be that stupid? And so you go back and look. Yeah, the Russians walked away from the ABM treaty. Oh, no, no, that was George W. Bush. Hey, the Russians, they broke the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Agreement. No, that was Donald Trump. So, and they're the who's offered to stay in New START? Oh, that would be the Russians. So they can't point to a single agreement. And then, again, Hodges in his ignorance. Well, they broke the Minsk II agreement. Russia was not a signatory to Minsk II. That was an agreement between the government of Ukraine and the leaders of the Donbass. Russia was a guarantor of it, just like Germany and France. But what the critical difference there was, Germany and France said it was a deliberate ploy to buy time for Ukraine. So this notion that, you know, the Russians can't be trusted and they break agreements, they're very legalistic when it comes to this stuff and very professional about it. And it's watching the United States, the clown show that's going on over here. We'll know that the actual negotiations are underway when Marco Rubio sits down with Sergei Lavrov. When that happens, then we can say, okay, there are actual substantive talks underway to bring this thing to an end, at least from the standpoint of the United States.
Now let's look at that aspect of things as well, because this gets even more complicated. It would be complicated enough just between the Russians and the United States, but of course you have to have Ukraine involved in there, and the Europeans want to be involved very much. But you mentioned Rubio. Interesting, he is not in Europe today, even though there is a foreign ministers conference at NATO.
Yeah.
His absence is very noteworthy. So he didn't go to Russia, and he didn't go to Europe, which seems to there's a lot we can read into that. I'll get your thoughts on that in a second. But Mark Rutte, talking about that meeting today, had this odd thing to say about negotiations at some point starting.
And so to discuss the implementation of that summit, particularly when it comes to defense spending, ramping up to 5% on a credible path. Defense industrial production, we have to do much more. We are doing better, but still a lot to be done. And of course, keeping Ukraine as strong as possible in the fight today, but also to be in the strongest possible position when peace talks really start to happen in a way where this could lead to a result.
So everything he talked about in the first part of that was spend more money, help Ukraine fight more, get more into the battle. And then later on, when negotiations start, even though by the time he was talking, probably the negotiators were still coming back from the meeting in Moscow, where we've been going back and forth many times since Trump got in. I mean, how much more in depth do you have to get before you're talking about starting them? What does that tell you about where the Europeans are?
Yeah, they're completely irrelevant to the process. So they're on the outside looking in. They're trying to find a way to make themselves, to insert themselves into the process. And Putin has made it clear that we've got nothing to talk to you about. So, you know, you stay out. They recognize that the United States support is critical. Now, Steve Bryan, who's a former DOD official back under, I think, George H.W. Bush, he put out something yesterday. I hadn't heard it, but I think he's got very good sources that now the U.S. has now cut off all military assistance to Ukraine within the last week. The items that were approved and by Congress and by Biden, no, they're not going forward now. And so when you couple, if that's true, and then you couple the fact that for the first time ever, the U.S. Secretary of State did not attend this NATO meeting, then, I think Trump may have reached finally the limit of his patience with the Ukrainians, because this is also playing out with the whole story of the corruption. And, you know, the $100 million is just the tip of the iceberg, but the whole corruption narrative has gotten some legs.
Well, where do you think that's going to go now and playing out? Because it's obviously an issue with at least some in Ukraine. I mean, with Mendich, I think his name was, and the second one.
Umarov. Was it Umarov?
Oh, not Umarov, but Yermak.
Oh, Yermak.
Right. So they're fine. Both having stepped back here. I mean, those are you could call them the right and left hand of Zelensky, and now they've both been dropped. I mean, at what point you have to say that probably the left and the right hand had some connection with the body, which was Zelensky. But so far, he's just pretending it didn't happen. And it seems that most in the West are okay with pretending that way. How's that going to work out?
Yeah, well, I think if this was allowed to be fully unraveled and the sunlight exposed to all the darkness here, we discover that there have been payments made to people like von der Leyen, payments made to Kaja Kallas. It's on the Europe. A number of people on the European side that have profited from this. Paybacks.
You really think they would, though? Because, I mean, that would be the most catastrophic thing in the world to actually take. If there's any possibility of finding a trail that would just sabotage those people, I mean, why would they risk literally everything for a little bit of cash?
Agreed. I mean, you know, it's all relative. You know, how much, you know, one of my former business partners, when he started with DEA, he had this old experienced guy pull him aside and said, "Hey, Bobby, what's your price?" Bobby goes, what do you mean? He goes, "What's your price?" He says, "You're going to get offered money by criminals to allow, look the other way. And, you know, you'll put yourself at risk. Just figure out what your number is." And Bobby's go, "Well," and the guy said, "Let me help you." Said he went through this formula, figure out how many years you're going to work, multiply your salary over that time, figure out how much money you would take for you to sit in jail for 10 years. And he said, "So whatever number you come up with, that's your number. And if the bad guys come up and offer you more than that, take it. But if it's less, don't." Well, in this case, they had billions of dollars to toss around. And so, you know, someone's getting $10 million, $20 million. I know at least one Republican senator that I was told got around $16, $17 million. One Democrat senator got around $23 million. And there are apparently 21 more members of Congress. I don't know how many House of Representatives and how many in the Senate that have got substantial sums of money. So I know that that money has flowed to U.S. pockets, and I would be shocked to believe that it hasn't flown and, you know, made its way into the hands and pockets of several critical leaders in the EU. And in fact, we saw just yesterday they went after and picked up the former, if you will, foreign minister for the EU. She's charged with corruption, you know. So, yeah, I'm sure that's going on now. Will it be allowed to work its way through with all the guilty will be charged? I doubt it. I think the people in the high places are generally going to be protected. But there will be some fall guys, and one of those fall guys is named Volodymyr Zelensky.
Yeah, of course, I bet they have to be careful with that, too. If what you say is true, if the evidence validates that later on, I mean, I can see where you'd have a situation like the Epstein files, where nobody wants to let that information out because people on all sides of the political spectrum would get hit. And if they turn on Zelensky, I mean, unless they take him physically out, like to his life, I mean, then they have to run the risk of him, you know, talking and singing like a bird. So that's something that's got to be calculated as well.
Yeah.
Speaking of the Ukraine side, though, so you just saw Mark Rutte. All he wants to talk about is more military aid and whatnot. And so we'll talk about peace later on when, as Ursula von der Leyen said earlier today, the only language Russia understands is that of force. And so it seems that message got through to the Ukrainian Speaker of the Parliament, who a couple of days ago talked about his red lines.
You know that from the very first day of the war, Ukraine has been striving for a peace that respects our independence, sovereignty, and our dignity. Ukraine is ready for substantive negotiations on ending the war, including at the level of leaders. At the same time, we must designate the Ukrainian red lines, which no one has the right to cross, neither physically, nor legally, nor morally. No legal recognition of the Russian occupation of Ukrainian territories. No restrictions on Ukraine's defense forces. No veto on Ukraine's right to choose its future alliances. Any genuine peace process must be based on a very clear principle: nothing about Ukraine without Ukraine, and nothing about Europe without Europe.
So that's the mantra there that they really want. But help me make sense. you talked to me, basically said that during this Witkoff meeting with Putin, that Putin laid out and said, here's our red lines. This is non-negotiable. Yeah. We won't do this. You're going to have to do that, et cetera. From a position of power and strength, that's an appropriate and understandable. Even if you don't like it, you can get it.
Right.
But this, make this make sense for me.
Well, it doesn't, you know, but it's reminiscent of what happened to the German army and the German political leadership in April of 1945. Their Führer was moving imaginary armies around on the battle map and saying, we're going to do this, we're not going to do that. You know, you can indulge these fantasies all day long, but the reality is, and we don't just judge this in terms of military power, but by every single measure you can take, what is the industrial production capability of Russia vice Ukraine? Superior, grossly superior. How about the, you know, in terms of the production of armaments, the weapon systems that are operable, that from, you know, hypersonic missiles to jet airplanes to cruise missile to drones, et cetera. And then the economy. Russia's got a debt to GDP ratio of 19%. Ukraine is now like 126%. So the point is, Russia is still in a position where it can finance the war. It doesn't have to go outside begging for money. Whereas Ukraine has no alternative but to beg for money. And then you look at who's Ukraine begging money from. It's everybody else who's broke. I mean, here's Germany, France, the UK. Their economies are in terrible shape. So, the military progress on the ground, the ability of Russia to recruit manpower to actually continue to build up its military strength, while Ukraine is going the opposite direction. It's bleeding manpower. You can't point to a single area where Ukraine has an advantage. Not one.